It's a Tech Thursday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In today's Tech Thursday, Ashton Carr discusses with UC Merced's Josh Veers the use of inclusive tech innovations to break the productivity paradox. And Taylor Charlstrom will have a report on how strawberries fared in last month's frost event. And I'll get us started with a check-in of regional agricultural news right after this.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
The show starts off now with a check-in of regional agricultural news. With greater emphasis and importance placed on sustainability efforts from organic growers and the grocery community, industry leaders will examine how the organic fresh produce industry is addressing the obstacles, opportunities, and the future of sustainability in the third Organic Produce Summit educational session. The 50-minute educational session called Sustainability Through the Supply Chain, What's Working and What's Not, will explore how fresh produce companies and retailers are working to transparently address environmental, social, and economic concerns throughout the life cycle of fresh produce items. The summit is a two-day event specifically designed to bring together organic fresh produce growers, shippers, and processors with retail and buying organizations from across North America. The sixth annual event will be held July 13th and 14th at the Monterey Conference Center in Monterey, California. In addition to the educational session on sustainability, other sessions slated will include a look at the growing importance of controlled environment agriculture, regenerative agriculture, branded versus private label organic offerings, and a data dive of organic fresh produce sales analysis and consumer purchasing behavior. The summit will also include two keynote presentations, a selection of field tours for qualified retailers and buyers, a gala opening night reception, and a sold-out trade show floor featuring over 150 producers and processors of organic fresh produce from across North America and the globe. More information will be made available in the coming weeks as the event's program becomes finalized. Registration to attend is available at organicproducesummit.com. Farmstead, the first online grocer to offer fresh, local fare plus national brands delivered for free at better prices than local supermarkets, and global logistics company Dematic, a leader in intelligent automation, have announced a partnership to help grocers drive operational efficiencies through software and automation. The Farmstead team built its grocery store OS software to run a company's own grocery business, but later licensing the solution to help others start and manage their own grocery e-commerce operations. Grocery OS is the only full-stack solution that provides everything a grocer needs to start a successful warehouse-powered grocery e-commerce and delivery operation in just 2 to 3 weeks, from sourcing warehouse space and inventory to coordinating delivery services. With Dematic Supply Chain Solutions, which power established and emerging brands, this partnership incorporates the final component of the warehouse in a box offering, allowing grocers to fully automate their business from receiving to fulfillment to shipping. Together, the two companies can provide an end-to-end solution for e-commerce, advanced grocery OS software integrated with Dematic's effective automation solutions that can significantly boost a grocer's e-commerce efficiency. The California Department of Food and Agriculture is partnering with the State Center Community College District and a Fresno Center for International Trade Development to launch an export training program for California food and agriculture companies. This training program, focusing on new-to-export agricultural businesses, will help companies prepare and succeed in international markets. International trade provides an opportunity for food companies to scale up their business, providing additional skill sets for employees and diversifying revenue streams, according to CDFA Secretary Karen Ross. Recent disruptions to the global food supply chain underscores the importance of trade. California farmers, ranchers, and food processors are well positioned to provide California-grown products to consumers worldwide. The California Agricultural Export Training Program, CalAgX, will begin in May. Registration is currently available. Attendees will learn from industry experts on issues related to logistics, finance, documentation, and import regulations. For more information, contact the California Department of Food and Agriculture. It has been widely reported that the Florida citrus crop for this year at 44.5 million 90-pound boxes is expected to be the smallest since the Second World War and 16.5% smaller than a previous year. Yet in some areas, citrus plantings are on the rise and some growers are starting to see them as a viable alternative to row crops. Reduced output is blamed on a disease known as citrus greening. It is still spreading through the region. The disease that has devastated the Florida citrus industry has been spotted in multiple locations in the southeast in recent years, including earlier this month in a small grove in Grady County, Georgia, according to Citrus Industry News. Citrus greening was also discovered in the Florida panhandles Franklin, Leon, Escambia, and Washington counties in 2021. Citrus greening isn't curable except by pulling up and destroying the trees, which can be heartbreaking after a multi-year investment of time and money. The best prevention method is to control the disease's insect vector, which is the Asian citrus ciliid.
The California Walnut Conference is back. Mark your calendars for April 7th and 8th at the Yuba Center Fairgrounds. This growing event has become the gem of Northern California Ag and brings walnut industry professionals together from across the Golden State. Be part of the experience and learn about new technologies, research, and meet with other ag insiders at the premier walnut conference in California. Register today at wcngg.com/events. The California Walnut Conference is powered by your top news resources in California, West Coast Nut, Progressive Crop Consultants, and My Ag Life.
On March 28th through the 30th, the International Conference on Digital Technologies for Sustainable Crop Production, otherwise known as DigiCrop, will hold its remote event. It will talk a little bit more about engineering, robotics, computer science, crop sciences, ag sciences, phenotyping, and economics, according to the DigiCrop website. We were able to chat with a few of the presenters at DigiCrop this year, one of those being Dr. Josh Veers, is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at UC Merced. He also serves as the campus director of the Center for Information Technology Research in the Interest of Society, otherwise known as CITRUS. He is set to give a presentation titled AI for Ag for the San Joaquin Valley, using inclusive innovation to break the productivity paradox. We learned more about this presentation from Dr. Veers himself.
It really does highlight what we're doing at UC Merced and a new initiative that we call F3. That's the Fresno Merced Future of Food Innovation Corridor, and that's an industry cluster in and around agri-food technology along Highway 99, which is in the San Joaquin Valley, probably the most productive agricultural space on the planet, but one that doesn't have the same level of industry engagement with its research universities. And so we're in the process of trying to change that up a little bit, and we're working with the California Department of Food and Agriculture, as well as the Central Valley Community Foundation and Fresno State as part of that partnership. To support that activity, we've been funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture as part of the newly funded Agricultural Artificial Intelligence Institute. And that is what we call AgAid, and that's for Transforming Workforce and Decision Support in Agriculture. And so that's in partnership with Washington State University and Oregon State University, as well as UC Merced. And that really is focused on leveraging artificial intelligence. And so my title, AI for Ag in the San Joaquin Valley, and that's using inclusive innovation to break the productivity paradox. And I can certainly kind of get more into the details on that. But as your listeners may know, is that the San Joaquin Valley, despite being one of the most productive agricultural spaces on the planet, it is also one of the most persistently poor in the United States. And so we have both a mission and a strategy to help undo that. And we think that this investment in ag food tech can help break that paradox and actually support our local communities in the process.
Dr. Veers got a little further into the conversation, talking more about how these solutions will impact some of these more low-income ag communities.
The statistics can be pretty startling in terms of well-being in and around human health and environmental health, and even just unemployment. Unemployment rates in the San Joaquin Valley are twice the national average. Some of the dirtiest air in America, in fact, is in the San Joaquin Valley. We have health outcomes that lag behind our counterparts in California and elsewhere in the U.S. And so we really think that we need to to undo that. But we also think that critical investments in ag food tech can help us spur the economic growth that's necessary to change that dynamic, yet at the same time, allow us to pursue a more sustainable agricultural future. And so we're focusing on climate resilient food systems. This is about improving the quality of food and efficiency of on-farm practices and bending regenerative practice toward a future with enhanced ag tech interventions. And so that's both the kind of the basic research and the applied research necessary to look at from producer to consumer along that entire value chain about how tech can do better for both humans and the planet. And so that includes everything from, you know, forecasting and data integration and decision making from the on-farm management as well as labor management through the entire supply chain. Certainly your listeners will be quite familiar with, you know, precision irrigation and some of the remote sensing. We're working quite a bit on a concept called Internet of Things for agriculture. And we were recently funded by the National Science Foundation through an engineering research center to work with University of Pennsylvania, Purdue, University of Florida, to bring some of that technology to bear in the San Joaquin Valley. And so you can imagine that on the tip of that technology might be biodegradable chaff type sensors that you could dispense from a drone flying over thousands of acres. And those little motes, if you will, could be collecting environmental data like soil moisture, transmitting that back to an edge computing system, in part because of our broadband issues and helping kind of overcome that, transmit it back to the cloud, and we'd be able to make real-time decisions. And then ultimately, those sensors may just dissolve right back into the soil. So those are the kinds of things that we're working on. But at the same time, you know, to your point about economic development and that paradox to which I was speaking, is that we think that by engaging local communities and farming communities in particular, farm labor, that we can approach this from what we call inclusive innovation by design. And the intent of that is to make these technologies affordable, accessible, and widespread. And so, you know, some examples of that is making sure that, you know, any technology that comes out of it is actually affordable by small scale farmers. And we think that this has benefits not just the San Joaquin Valley, but exportable technology to other parts of the world, including Asia, Latin America, Africa, of course. It needs to be appropriately scaled, which means that, you know, that it isn't just for, you know, large enterprises. And a lot of ag tech early on, as you're probably aware, happened in the Midwest, in part because of being able to automate combines and tractors and working in large swaths of corn and soy. California's diverse agriculture makes that a little bit more difficult. There are a lot of specialty crops. There are a lot of perennial crops such as almonds and walnuts and pistachios now increasing quite a bit, as well as citrus. And each one of those kind of has a different technological profile, if you will. So, you know, we're looking to make sure that the tech that comes out of this research could be scaled across the different sizes of farms, but also to different types of crops. Another aspect of this is that we're, you know, certainly making sure that the tech that comes out of this is low risk, in part because a lot of the smaller farmers don't have the access to capital necessary to be able to make big investments in risky technology. And so we want to make sure that it's a proven technology. And as part of that, something that I'm very excited about is that UC Merced is beginning to develop an experimental smart farm. We're just in the design phases now, but what we're hoping is that this will be not just a research space, but also a demonstration space and one that we can benchmark a variety of these different technologies.
In national agricultural news today, U.S. food and agriculture groups have released the sixth annual Feeding the Economy report. The report's findings show that 7% of the nation's economy and 29% of American jobs are linked to the food and agriculture sectors, either directly or indirectly. Amidst a global supply chain and inflation crisis, these sectors also exported $182.91 billion worth of goods, helping the U.S. maintain its position as a leading player in global agriculture. In 2021, sectors contributed a total of $3 trillion to the U.S. economy. The report shows the total food and industry economic impact at $7.43 trillion. John Bode, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Corn Refiners Association, says the report highlights how food and agriculture overcame pandemic disruptions to continue to serve as a bedrock of the U.S. economy. Other groups involved in the effort include the American Farm Bureau Federation, the Food Industry Association, and the National Restaurant Association. The farm share of the food dollar increased 1 cent in 2020, according to new data from the USDA's Economic Research Service. On average, U.S. farmers receive 16 cents for every commodity sales from each consumer dollar spent on domestically produced food in 2020, up from a revised 15 cents in 2019. Known as the farm share, the 1 cent rise is the largest increase in nearly a decade. On the other hand, the marketing share goes to food supply chain industries that move domestically produced food from farms to points of purchase, including costs related to packaging, transporting, processing, and selling to consumers at grocery stores and eating out places. In the first year of the coronavirus pandemic, households redirected a substantial amount of their eating out dollars or food away from home spending towards food at home markets such as grocery stores. Generally, farmers receive a smaller share from eating out dollars because a larger portion is spent on preparing and serving meals at restaurants, cafeterias, and other food service establishments. John Deere has announced this week it will enhance the capabilities of existing diagnostic tools and expand their availability. In 2023, the company will roll out an enhanced customer solution that includes a mobile device interface. The Environmental Protection Agency failed to assess potential harm to endangered species when setting water quality standards for the heavy metal cadmium, according to a new lawsuit filed by the Center for Biological Diversity. Cadmium is used in a production and is found in phosphate fertilizers. In a complaint filed with the U.S. District Court for the District of Arizona, the environmental group asked the court to declare EPA in violation of federal law for not completing an endangered species consultation when in 2016 it adopted freshwater chronic criteria for cadmium under the Clean Water Act. The lawsuit asked the court to vacate the criteria and remand them back to EPA. According to the lawsuit, the application of phosphate fertilizer releases 33 to 56% of total cadmium into the environment. Cadmium is often detected in runoff from urban and industrial areas, and rivers are a major secondary source of cadmium in the ocean, according to the lawsuit. As of 2007, cadmium has been identified at 1,014 of the 1,669 most serious hazardous waste sites on the National Priorities List. Of those 1,014 sites, cadmium was identified in surface waters at 354 sites and in groundwater at 675 sites. Fertilizer contains cadmium because phosphate rock is used as a key feedstock in fertilizer production. According to the Pacific Northwest Pollution Prevention Resource Center, cadmium is taken up by and stored in plants, accumulates in soil during a period of time, or leaches into groundwater, or is carried into surface waters through irrigation runoff. The lawsuit alleges EPA weakened water quality criteria and then approved the adoption of the criteria in at least 18 states. On Tuesday, visitors to Washington, D.C. were treated to seeing the famous cherry blossoms at their peak, and they also got a close-up at the latest in remarkable farm technology. USDA Farm News reporter Gary Crawford.
Out here on the Mall in Washington, D.C., we haven't had this many tractors on the grounds since those big farmer tractorcades of the 1980s. But in this case, the tractors and other farm machines are not here to protest, but to celebrate and educate. Tuesday was National Agriculture Day. One of the coordinators of this Ag Day event here in D.C., Kurt Blades, with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. He and others helped to bring together people and equipment from some 30 companies and organizations.
To really give a display that celebrates modern agriculture and how technology is really leading to a more sustainable food production system.
On hand out here for Ag Day, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Folks, I think this is a great day to celebrate. We're out, we're together, we're united, we have big challenges but big opportunity, and we're rising to the challenge. Happy Ag Day, folks.
On the Mall in Washington, D.C., this is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A new study from food and agriculture groups, including the American Farm Bureau Federation, shows the economic impact of agriculture. Farm News reporter Michael Clements shares more on how the data can be used to demonstrate the importance of farming and ranching.
The sixth annual Feeding the Economy study reveals how the food and agriculture sectors influence the local and broader United States economies. American Farm Bureau Federation Chief Economist Dr. Roger Cryan says the study helps the public understand the impact of agriculture.
Feeding the economy is a number of different things. It's a study and it's a website, feedingtheeconomy.com, and it's a partnership among ag groups. It's aimed at helping folks better understand the impact of agriculture.
He says the data drives home that agriculture is the foundation of the U.S. economy.
For the U.S. as a whole, there were about $3 trillion in output in the agriculture sector. This includes the jobs and wages and output directly involved in supplying and producing and delivering through the food and agricultural supply chain. Agriculture is a massive industry. And so, again, for the U.S., $3 trillion in output, 21.5 million jobs, $819 billion in wages.
Cryan says it's all about helping others understand the importance of American agriculture.
We know that agriculture is important in many different ways, but for those who need more black and white convincing about how important agriculture is, this is very helpful. FeedingTheEconomy.com will feed you the numbers for the U.S. and for your state and even for your congressional district. And the objective here is to provide absolutely up-to-date information about how important agriculture is. It helps folks understand, as much as we take it for granted, that the food is there when we need it.
Again, learn more at feedingtheeconomy.com. Michael Clements, Washington.
And in keeping with our mission to serve as the informed voice for mental health in rural America, Rural Minds is launching a Rural Mental Health Connections webinar series. This inaugural Rural Mental Health Connections webinar will focus on the power of sharing lived experience and confronting mental health challenges. It is the first of four free mental health educational webinars in the 2022 event series. This webinar will be on April 13th, and it'll be at 5 p.m. Pacific time. It will be presented live via Zoom with the option to hear live audio as listen only. All recorded video and audio content will be archived and available post-event on the Rural Minds website. For more information, log on to ruralminds.org. That's RURALminds.org.
Recent frosts at the Cal Poly Farm in San Luis Obispo, California has brought frost injury in all its variety. According to the Compendium of Strawberry Diseases, quote, frost injury is probably the most common non-pathogen-related and non-insect-related disorder affecting strawberry flowers and fruit. When temperatures dip to below freezing, expect to see a variety of deformed fruit and blackened flowers. Cal Poly Strawberry Center's Gerald Holmes said that the injuries are really just happening at that moment in time and don't affect the plant for the rest of the season as they will recover. However, the extent of the injury varies with the stage of flower development, temperature, and duration.
It's going to affect some places more than others. Obviously, strawberries are grown along the coast. Many of them are going to be protected by the ocean temperatures that won't really allow any kind of a freeze. So you'll see it more severe in areas where the ocean has less influence, right? So the further inland you go, then you'll see a little more frost damage. And we didn't see that much industry-wide. I'm only thinking about Santa Maria, the east side of Santa Maria. I think Oxnard really didn't have any measurable impact from the freeze. Cal Poly, we saw a fair amount because we had several days in a row that dipped down into freezing temperatures. So when that happens, the fruit, the plants are not that susceptible. It's the blooms. So the blooms freeze. And of course, it's the blooms that we want because we're producing strawberries. We're not producing plants. And those blooms will freeze and they won't produce fruit. Or if they do, they'll produce fruit that are misshapen and they don't really make the first quality. So they might have to be discarded. So if the fruit are just very much in the early bloom stage, they'll turn black from the frost and they just won't make any fruit at all. If they're in later stages, then what happens is the floral parts get damaged, and then as the fruit develops, it doesn't develop properly, and so it ends up being kind of funky in shape.
The entire flower may be lost or only a few pistils, in which case the result is the malformed fruit. In later stages of fruit development, one might see a woody portion of the fruit where achenes are tightly spaced. In mature fruit, the pith may be corky and slightly brownish. Thankfully, these deformations don't contribute to any other issues associated with strawberry plants, including pest and disease incidents.
Basically, you freeze the fruit that are out there at that moment, and then the plant will produce more. And in this particular case, this year it was pretty minimal, the damage. And so you'll basically sacrifice a few harvests, and then the plant will be right back into production mode, and it doesn't really influence it later on.
Holmes said that strawberry growers usually keep frost in mind each year, but it's one of their lesser concerns compared to other pests and diseases that they have to look out for.
We just have to, year in and year out, be mindful of it. People might select their growing sites because of it if they've had a bad experience. And they typically know the risk if they're planting winter crop strawberries that they're going to be in an area that's susceptible to frost. That's something they have to factor in. But I don't think they're any more worried about it now than they have been in the past. There are some things you can do about it. Some people will run their sprinklers during the period that they expect the low temperatures, and that water will freeze on the plants and kind of create an insulation, a barrier, if you will, to the temperatures going much below freezing. So if they stay right at 32 degrees, you're basically protected. It's when you get down into the mid-20s and stay there for hours and hours, that's when you get the real damage. And so keeping the sprinklers on that can help. There are always products out there that people claim will mitigate the frost injury to some degree. These typically will not protect from a really hard frost, but if it's just a degree or two, for a short period of time, they can be effective. We are all familiar with the wind machines that have been put up in citrus orchards, for example, citrus groves, to invert the air, get the warmer air up top to come down. Those can be helpful, again, when you have a short period of time and you're only talking about a few degrees, then those are very, very helpful. But obviously a big investment, and most strawberry fields don't have those wind machines available to them. But obviously the other thing is choosing where you're growing, and the closer you are to the coast, the more protected you're going to be from frost events.
While the Compendium of Strawberry Diseases, as was noted earlier, says that frost injury is probably the most common non-pathogen-related and non-insect-related disorder affecting strawberry flowers and fruit, sunburn is actually probably more worrisome and more important.
You can also get heat damage. When it gets too hot, the fruit can be sunburned, and we get more hot days in the summer than I would say freezing temperatures in the winter. And once it gets hot like that, those effects are a little more difficult to manage. I would say frost, though, figures pretty prominently on the things that strawberries can experience that aren't pest-related.
This is Taylor Charlstrom reporting for My Ag Life.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.